Next case in our calendar is 98-22-14, Disciplinary Counsel versus Claire M. Ball, Jr. Mr. Slovery. If he didn't choose to do that in the court process.
Prosecuted in this case. Senator, again, we felt that by cutting off our vote, we've got evidence of the circumstances surrounding the indictment and the plea.
We have it.
Sorry.
Is there any evidence to be asked to see the indictment? Who's got the
on the basis of trying to negate the conviction or even the plea. You're talking about that in mitigation in answer to the question.
We talked about that with mitigation. Here are the other problems we have with the court's decision. The witnesses that we put forward, the court put their testimony only in mitigation. We were putting forward
fitness to practice law go to penalty, or does it come in where the rule says that you have to make a determination when you come to be reinstated?
No, I think it should go to penalty. I think all of the circumstances surrounding this situation need to be taken into consideration when you're focusing on penalty. You're talking about a person subjected to an extended period of time of potentially humiliation in his own community, as all of this is pending. A person that has made a decision rather than try to fight 51 felony counts, plead out for 30 misdemeanors. There are economic considerations, there are considerations of long and protracted trial, there are considerations of saying you find it as law practice, but all of this is being played out very visibly in the community. We all might have to do a penalty in this case. It did not understand we deal with this all these voters practice law. This is always representing a high and bigger
number. Now, I want to refer you back to the opening comment that was it on the charge of moral turpitude. Could you elaborate on that? If I understand your argument, the only evidence was put on was the conviction. And usually case law indicates something more than that is required.
We believe that the first reference case and the first case indicates that there should be something more looked at in assessing.
Our practice has usually been that if somebody is a lawyer has been sanctioned once and then comes back to us, and now the question is what's the new sanction. Usually the new sanction is at least as great as the original sanction. He was suspended for 6 months, and now you're asking for a public reprimand. That seems to be going the wrong way to me. I guess I need to hear your argument.
First of all, the activity that's the subject of this, most other cases that have been determined where the second penalty was more harsh than the first involved activities of the lawyer and the officer of the court. In other words, the lawyer was practicing before the court was involved in the active practice of law. This situation did not involve the active practice of law. It was a voluntary activity that was involved in the community. The situation that Mr. Ball was found in violation of the rule is a case of first impression by this court, and did involve his activities as an officer. So I make it distinguishing. One would be that this did not involve his activity as an officer. Of course, secondly, Your Honor, not all of the cases, or not all of the instances that this court found a harsher penalty for the second time around than for the first.
I don't need to talk to you about the importance of the integrity of the elections, but I guess I'm not very persuaded by the fact that this conduct did not occur in his law office or with respect to a client. It seems to me that the integrity of elections in our country and democracy is fundamental. It's basic. It's something we do so much to protect. And here is a person who clearly violated that principle. Have to be a lawyer. And I guess I wonder what message we would be sending if we would say, well, yeah, you tampered with elections. You pleaded guilty to a number of counts, but we're just going to say it's just a public record. Don't do that again. Is that the message we really should be giving to the bar, to the public?
Yes,
sure. Prosecuted. I mean, I don't. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, our president government is guilty of election law violations last year.
Not tampering with ballots, not trying to change, have people register. I don't think he did that.
They are, in this instance, involved in attempting to register college students. Well, recognize that trying to pin down the address of college students.
As a lawyer, just take away that he was not a public official. I grant you that, but he's a lawyer. He's supposed to have a standard that we hold people to. I guess that's my concern.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown.
First of all, I'd like to talk about the respondent's argument that he should have been allowed to present evidence regarding allegedly selective prosecution. The Raider has long maintained in this case that the time to argue about selective prosecution was at a criminal trial. This court has recognized as recently as a couple weeks ago in the Jason Jeffrey death penalty case that if you want to make an argument that the prosecutor brought charges that are somehow precluded under the Constitution, you make that argument at your criminal trial. The Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline in a disciplinary case is not going to hear all the evidence about selective prosecution. This respondent went to a plea hearing and entered a guilty plea to 30 first-degree misdemeanors. We're well beyond the argument about selective prosecution. Any information, any evidence regarding that is irrelevant and was probably excluded by the panel and by the board. I would also like to comment on the fact that the respondent has repeatedly maintained that he was cut off from presenting evidence that would have helped him to establish that the crimes were not those involving moral turpitude. Well, I would like to draw this court's attention to the panel's entry, which was entered a couple days before the hearing, about the evidence he would be allowed to present. And in addition to the information given to you by the respondent in his brief, the panel's entry also states, the panel may choose to inquire as to respondent's reasons for doing the act that gave rise to his brief. So in other words, in that entry, the panel is inviting the respondent to give testimony about the reasons he did what he did. But we don't know what those reasons are because the respondent did not give any such testimony. In addition, at the hearing, and this occurs in the hearing transcript at pages 44 and page 46, the chair of the panel, Bernie Hurst-Webb, states, while you can talk the motivation, the reason behind what you did, and to whether we're talking about moral turpitude, it does not say you can question the guilt or innocence. Excuse me, and that's in reference to Burkhardt's decision, disciplinary counsel versus Burkhardt. The panel repeatedly asked the respondent to talk about why he did the act. And the respondent chose not to do that. The only thing he was precluded from giving evidence on was his guilt or innocence. And that was properly precluded by the court.
Because of what? You know, different than
address the issue of the level of proof required on the issue of moral turpitude, who did the burden of the law. You seem to be saying that it's a lawyer who is charged.
I'm suggesting a couple different things. Regarding the issue of moral turpitude, first of all, Governor Rule 5, Section 5C provides that a certified copy of the judgment entry of conviction of an offense shall be conclusive evidence of the commission of that offense in any disciplinary proceeding instituted against the attorney as a result of that offense.
Okay, so
we start there, okay? Then what we have to do is we look deeper. We look inside the conviction. For example, if we look at the bill of particulars, count one of the bill of particulars states, on or about the 13th day of March, 1996, in Athens County, Ohio, the defendant did, and I'll add the word count, did attempt to solicit or procure another to vote the ballot of another which had not been obtained lawfully from precinct authority, that being the ballot for behalf Burton. By pleading guilty to that count and 14 others just like it, the respondent admitted that he attempted to solicit some other individual which ballot had not been lawfully obtained from precinct authority and vote that ballot. That occurred a minimum of 15 times. There are two levels of crime there. The first being an unlawfully obtained ballot, and the second is that ballot is voted by someone other than the person that should have been voting. And the second 16 crimes committed in this case talk about offenses that were involving registering voters to vote at an address which they did not actually live. In other words, registering absentee voters to vote someplace in a precinct or a ward different than they were assigned to vote, different than their actual residence. Respondent admitted that he attempted to solicit someone to do that registration every 15 times. So those are the facts that we're faced with. Those are the facts that are presented with the panel, to the panel. And the panel properly did what they were supposed to do under the Burkhardt analysis. And we totally agree with respondents that you should be doing the analysis that works in Burkhardt. You should be looking beyond the actual crime, how they appear on paper. The very nature of the crimes that respondents committed are clear and convincing proof of conduct involving moral turpitude. Moral turpitude is much more than conduct that is base and vile and depraved. Moral turpitude, in accordance with the Burkhardt decision, has to be measured against the community standards of morality, honesty, and justice. And when you take an individual that is registering voters at a place other than where they live, and voting the ballot for someone who's not the actual voter, I mean, those are crimes that are, they are involving moral turpitude. They are beyond community standards of honesty, morality, and justice. And we believe that the indictments in those particulars and the plea itself are adequate, clear, convincing proof of crimes involving moral turpitude.
There are other charges there, though. So, please, back on this one. I guess I took the underlying implication that was submitted on this is that maybe the community standard here is not what you might think. It's a low standard.
Well, in response to that, Your Honor.
I mean, that seems to be the undercurrent I'm getting here. And then I guess the argument is that there wasn't a presentation of evidence as to what is the community standard in Hampton County with respect to.
Give you some idea of what community standard is in Athens County. There was 30 first degree misdemeanors. He was fined $1,000 on each misdemeanor. That's the maximum, as you well know. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail on each misdemeanor. That's the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
These are not minor. These are not accepted violations. They're serious misdemeanors. And he also admitted to being indicted for 51 fourth degree felonies. And then we have plea negotiations, which this court well knows, and it results in a plea that 31st degree misdemeanor. each one individually, a separate act involving moral turpitude.
Well, Ms. Brown, I guess my question is, what's the community? In a case like this, this is not a pornography case where every community may have a little different subjective opinion about what is pornography or whatever. This is election law. It seems to me that, you haven't argued this, but it seems to me we may want to look beyond one local community in determining what the community standard. Certainly, if there's a group of people in the community who have a standard lower than what the statute certainly requires and what all of our law requires, I would think we wouldn't. We might want to go beyond that group of people, I guess is my point. It seems to me here the community would be at least the state. I mean, the state has an interest in fair, honest elections. And I guess you haven't argued it, but it seems to me that to say that a few people can determine that election laws can be sort of fudged and, you know, we can cheat in this community and say, well, okay, that's the standard. I have a hard time accepting that, I guess. I asked Mr. Celebrity enough questions. I didn't give him that one, but it seems to me that I wouldn't concede, I guess, that the community is Athens County.
Yes, and I didn't mean to concede that, Your Honor. In general, obviously the Office of Disciplinary Counsel began from the standpoint that he violated Ohio law, 3599.26, 3599.11. Beginning from that point is where, we didn't try this case in Athens. His mitigation went into the effort from Athens, but other than that, frankly, our disciplinary rules are statewide, and that's the basis from which we began in order to try and prove our case, prove that there was clearness in the evidence. I would like to address briefly respondent's contention that his conduct does not violate 112A6. I believe there's somewhat of a misunderstanding regarding A6 in this case. We've never alleged that respondent did not fit practice law. We're not alleging that. We are alleging that he violated A6. In other words, he engaged in conduct that adversely reflects on his fitness. He presented mitigation witnesses, that's true. The mitigation witnesses testified as to his character and reputation in the community. That is separate and apart from the issue of whether his conduct violates 112A6. With regard to the issue of whether his conduct violates 112A4, relator submits that voting the ballot of someone else when that ballot has not been lawfully obtained from precinct authorities is inherently dishonest and deceitful. Registering someone to vote at an incorrect address is dishonest and deceitful. That violates 112A4. We would also submit that the case cited by respondents, Athens Bar versus Murray, is distinguishable. In that case, the respondent committed one misdemeanor, violated an ATV statute of a building code, and he was fined $1,000. There was no complicity, no tampering with ballots, and he received a public remedy. This case is much, much different than that case.
That's really what we're hear about, I think, on the penalty issue, Ms. Brown, and I'd like to talk about that for a minute, if we could. I mean, there's not any question. He pled to the 30 misdemeanor counts, and as the Chief has indicated, it's a serious business. You have recommended, the relator has recommended, there be a two-year suspension. Obviously, the other side says public reprimand. With the seriousness of these counts as you recite them, what do you suppose this panel was thinking and the board when they gave a one-year suspension? Because you have a pretty good panel here. I guess they're all good panels. A panel that I'm familiar with, and I know each of them. And the board seems to have given us the one-year recommendation. Why should we not follow that, or why should we go more or less?
For a couple different reasons. First of all, this is not a case where there is a one count, one crime, one instance of failing to file a tax return. There are cases decided by this court prior to this case that indicate that multiplicity of crimes can be considered in increasing the amount of time that is required to be suspended from the practice of law. each of these 30 crimes is a separate instance of misconduct. This isn't about one instance of misconduct that he was charged with several different crimes as a result of the
crime. Okay, I understand that. We've been through that. My question is, why would the panel, do you suppose, have done what they did and the board did what it did in recommending to us? And what is there to be said other than all that you've said of how serious this is? Why should we be persuaded to increase it to 2 years when the finder of fact in two instances has said, no, it shouldn't be?
I think, addressing the issue of a public official, I think that should be addressed when you consider the appropriate things in this regard.
Okay, now let's stop there a minute, because I read your cases, Bazooka and Smock, I think, is the way you pronounce them, and both of those were public officials.
Yes.
In this case, he is not.
He's a former public official.
Okay.
And in this case, he is charged with crimes involving elections. I think if we had a respondent who was a former public official, not as a public official at the time, who's charged with credit card fraud or money laundering, something totally, some of the white collar crimes, totally unrelated to elections, you have a different case. Would I be standing up here arguing that he should be held to the standard of a public official? No. But this is a crime that is very specific to actions that take you aback when you talk about public officials tampering with an election, trying to influence the results of an election. I think that is definitely aggravating.
What influenced the panel was the fact that mitigation and what is for numerous persons testified concerning his background.
I think that's certainly possible. He had a number of, as he said, live character witnesses that talked about his reputation in the community, and I think that's a consideration. From our standpoint, that's a consideration that mitigates against an even stronger indefinite suspension. I think you also need to put appropriate emphasis on the fact that the respondent has been disciplined before.
But why shouldn't we consider the mitigation as the panel and the board has considered it? Why do you want us to ignore, or by implication ignore, what the panel and the board obviously took into consideration in recommending a 1 year suspension?
I understand that. Our position is that the misconduct was much more serious than perhaps recognized. We totally agree with the panel and the board findings that there was an A3, an A4, and an A6 violation. No question about that. We're starting from a higher standpoint. We are starting from the premise, supported by case law, that he should receive a 2 year suspension. Now, perhaps the panel started at a different place and considered the mitigation testimony and came back to recommending a 1 year suspension. We also considered his previous discipline. He was disciplined for conduct involving failure to supervise his secretary, who ultimately stole hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Did you consider the mitigation?
Did we consider it? Yes. Yes. I recognize that he had witnesses to testify that they had received good legal representation from him, that he was available and active in his community. We recognize that. And we can still stand here today and completely recommend it to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Stubbs, you've used your time. Can we take 30 seconds?
Evidence they would consider motivation, I'm certain. these types of business than the standard normally is, that the intent of the board can actually be determined by the board of election, vote is counted. If it cannot be determined, the vote is not counted. They're satisfied that there is not normal, it's not routine.
The case will be submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.